Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And I'm really excited for this one because I am joined by the wonderful Charles Landry. We got to know each other through the World City Fellows program in Copenhagen earlier this summer. We had some great chats, we really hit it off, and you know what, just when you get to hang out in one of the world's best cities or most livable cities or however you want to grade it, Copenhagen's fantastic, and be around a bunch of other urbanists including Charles and just sort of get to the heart of an issue and chat about why something works or why something's interesting, you end up going to some good places. So I wanted to bring some of that experience to this podcast. So here we are. And many people will know Charles. He's probably best known for pioneering the idea of the creative city. He's also behind the Creative Bureaucracy Festival in Berlin. And he's really pushed us to think of cities less like machines and more like people, and all the psychology that comes along with that. So that might be the confidence, the neuroses, the insecurities of being human. So in our chat, we're going to talk about what it might mean when a place suffers from some of those things. We can look at how that happens between cities. Maybe that's Essen comparing itself enviously with Dusseldorf. Maybe it's a city that's perhaps overcompensating, like a Dubai. Maybe it's somewhere that's scarred by the trauma of history and working out how it moves forward, like a Coventry. Anyway, we're really going to go into the psychology of these cities, why confidence can fuel creativity, why people don't always want to stay what they are, but they do want to stay where they are, and how some architecture can just feel like maybe it doesn't like people very much. We're going to get into all sorts of these things over the course of a conversation. And yeah, loads of examples, lots of nice fluffy stuff in there too. But without further ado, let's get into a conversation with the fantastic Charles Landry.
I really appreciate you being up for giving some of your time to have a chat with me for the podcast, because I made an idiot out of myself when I first met you in Copenhagen earlier this year by getting your name completely wrong.
Yeah, hi. Look, I'm really pleased, Ian, to be on your podcast. I suppose a tiny bit about me. I'm associated with the idea of the creative city. The one sentence summary of that is, in a world of dramatic change, how do you create the conditions for people, organizations, and the city itself to think, plan, and act with imagination to solve problems and create opportunities? So that's been a lot of what I've done. But in terms of just bumping into today, you know, I've sort of tried to help cities and some of that's worked, and I've written quite a few books, one of them called The Art of City Making. But one thing that's really taken off over the last years is I had this idea, I'm going to use the word creative one more time. So I said creative bureaucracy in 2003. Everybody's thought, are you bloody mad? What do you mean? But suddenly, about 15 years later, it took off. And basically what it's saying is, look, if you want an ecosystem of interesting, vibrant, agile places, the public administration is somehow involved in one way or another. So that needs to be as equally imaginative as anybody else might need to be. And so that's been really quite a big chunk of what I've been doing lately. And it's a festival in Berlin where 2,300 people come from many countries. So I'll leave it at that. But within all of this, I've done stuff about psychology and cities, how you have a civic city in a nomadic world, and so on and so on.
I think it was the sort of psychology in the city, and the way that when we met and I got the luxury of spending a few days around you and seeing how you reflect on what you've seen in a city when we're in Copenhagen, the way that you sort of ask questions around how people were thinking about things when they're making a part of a city. How did you get to that point where you could talk and be really confident around cities as these creative psychology, where psychology matters just as much as the sort of hardcore engineering or the more traditional planning based way of thinking about a city?
No, that was really interesting. It took quite a long time, and I was very lucky when I was young because there was a foundation in the UK called the Roundtree Trust, which had an element where you didn't have to be a charity. And when I was young, they, for various reasons, said, hey, just write me a letter once a year. Nobody would ever say that now. One pager saying you're doing something vaguely in the public good. And for 5 years, I got a chunk of money, which more or less paid me. So I made a lot of mistakes along the way, as you can imagine. But it allowed me to explore. And so I've always felt this, I've got this sort of slightly insatiable curiosity. And so I'm always trying to push the boundaries. And one of those boundaries I was trying to push is to say, look, We all know that a city is hardware. We know it's software, if you want to use computer language, and orgware as well. So I was really diving into the softer side of things and suddenly thought, look, isn't psychology, you know, how we perceive things, the first impression of a city? Does it feel like it's saying no? Is it overwhelming? Does it make you feel generous because it itself is generous? All of these things. And so then I hooked up with an old friend of mine who also happened to be interested in psychology. And funnily enough, when I was about 13, 14, 15, I just read psychological books, which is bizarre, rather than novels or anything, and then didn't touch the topic 40 years. So anyway, there we are. We got back into it. And so I kept on thinking with this guy, Chris Murray, what if we treated a city as if it was a person? And when I then first did a psychoanalysis of a city or something, I'd already had luck to have somehow hit upon the creative city idea. And that, because that had taken off, I felt confident enough to say, hey, guys, let's just stretch the boundary a bit. And as I'm getting older and sort of, you know, I'm not saying life's easier, but you know what I mean. I've thought, why not just do whatever you like, you know, and just see what happens. And so that's how I then didn't mind just pushing that out and then asking various people. And I have over the years asked people who I've admired in cities and said, I remember Ghent. There was this socialist mayor who could talk to rich people and poor people. And I said, hey, Daniel, I really like you in Ghent. Can I work with you? So I began to do that. Just, can I work with you? And some people say yes. Some say no, of course. But then on this basis of critical friend that you and I have discussed, it makes life easier, you know, and obviously you hope that they give you a bit of money that you can survive.
When you think about that, those sort of places, and you've worked with a lot of them, you've been to a lot of them, are there cities that really stand out to you as... Cities have their stereotypes. Like, people will look at like Parisians being a bit aloof, but also other people will be like, oh, it's the city of love and whatnot. Are there places that you look at and go, that psychology really stands out in terms of how you experience and feel that city?
Absolutely.
I guess it's different for every person as well. It's like if you go as a visitor versus if you live there, it's totally different psychologies of the city.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. That's why I love the fact that we're talking about this. It's not the only topic we can talk about. We can talk about lots of things. But clearly, there are cities that have inferiority complexes. I mean, you know, Liverpool versus Manchester and stuff like that. You know, other places, Munich versus Augsburg and all the cities there. And they're all saying, oh, we don't like Munich or whatever. So there are cities that have inferiority complexes based either on the fact that they are actually smaller and less successful. Or, and I'll give you a very good German example, Düsseldorf and Essen were both industrial cities. But Düsseldorf suddenly became the capital of the region. Then all the strategic entities come. It then becomes a tech city, a knowledge city. The Japs come, putting in high-tech stuff. Essen, the industrial city, still is industrial and feels very down. The reason I know that, I've just done a sort of 2-day workshop with them. So that's a classic example of inferiority complex. The other is, of course, the overcompensation. Dubai, I've got to have the biggest, tallest building in the world. Thank you very much. You know, so fear of irrelevance drives excess or something. Then the other neurosis that people have, obviously, you know these things, is a sort of fixation on the past, on nostalgia or something like that. I mean, I'm not saying Venice is like that, but there are lots of places where they sort of do a version of, well, we've always been like this, and why should we try and uproot the tried and tested? So that can happen. And those then become museumized a bit. And those do. What's interesting is when they get a new mayor who might be, or a new grouping who then thinks a bit afresh. I mean, Bruges is an example of the museum city, but a new group came in and said, look, it can't just be the past. But that's one. The other thing I think is, You know, there's a neurosis about, I mean, we did a psychological assessment of Coventry, which was bombed in the war, as you know. And we called the little book called Coventry on the Couch. If we were talking about Stockholm, we'd be talking Stockholm on the sofa or something. But what we're basically saying, if you've had that past being destroyed, has it etched itself so deeply into you that you can't really move ahead? Now, it's much more nuanced because, you know, there was the Coventry sound and, you know, these young folks, bugger that, shit, we just are who we are. But there is an element of that, definitely, you know, oh my God. Then, of course, what people sometimes do is they just erase things, you know, slum clearance or whatever, you know, that's happened in many places. So that's a bit on neurosis. There's more to say.
No, you start with Dusseldorf, and Dusseldorf is one of my favourite cities. And I remember I got invited to a party in New York. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't go. I'm going to Dusseldorf for the weekend. And I got looked at like I was I was a lunatic. Like there was something genuinely wrong with me for wanting to go to Dusseldorf. But I actually think it's one of those cities. I've got a very good friend who lives there. So it changes how you experience a city. But it's one of those places that it's got that sort of quiet, understated confidence. But it still has its own chip on its shoulder when it looks at Cologne. And I think it's like a fascinating place when in terms of as a place to live, work, play, they've kind of got a lot of things right. But they just don't promote themselves to tourists because they don't really want tourists.
Yeah. And to some extent, they don't need to because there is an economic base there that is, you know, very strong. No, but that's one topic. I mean, the reason we do this psychoanalysis of cities or psychotherapy or whatever is we're just trying to say, let's look at things differently, which is just like when we're doing this creative city assessment, how creative are you? We're not there saying there's a simple idea of what that could be, but we basically give a rather simplistic assessment from 1 to 10. But what we're doing it for is to say, hey, this is the situation that people say collectively about you. What would being a 5 mean? You're a 5 average between 10. But what would a 6 mean? What are the sort of things you would need to do? So it just opens the conversation away from that classic, yes, the land use planning is this, the separation of that. Where are we going to? Are we going to allow shopping centres? Will we allow high rise? It sort of gets somehow a wider conversation, which requires, in my view, a more collective group of skills, which could be many things, like a historian could be good just as much as, I suppose a sociologist or an anthropologist or a culture.
A friend of mine who's been on this podcast, he came to Montreal on holiday and he's a transit nerd. But he discovered the Montreal transit system. They have 2 historians on staff. And I think it's an amazing thing. Like most people would look at that as that's an indulgence. I think it's a great thing because it's if you've got that where you can look back to the past, that then means you can probably think a bit differently of how does the system build out in the future and what are you doing differently? What have you lost that you should be bringing back? So I love how you bring that up. It connects the dots for me.
No, but I think you're so right about that. Yeah.
In terms of when you do this work with cities, are there places that you feel that are more confident in others? So the original question I kind of wanted to ask you was very much around why are cities so bad at being themselves? And I actually think it's not, some cities are fantastic at being themselves and some really struggle with it, but maybe it's how the more confident you are, the more creative you can be. So you see some of those places that they don't have the confidence to be creative, so they surround themselves in all the logical planning documents in the process, whereas other places go, well, what if we tried that?
Yeah, now, that's a good complicated question, obviously, as you know, but I'd quite like to answer it in one sense because of you just mentioned Montreal, because what struck me a while back is places that have a bit of an identity. When I say problem, but, you know, Montreal is in Quebec and so on. Barcelona is Catalonia in Spain. Bilbao is the Basque country within Spain. I've noticed that those places are actually very interesting and often very creative, but also a bit chippy. They're both confident and chippy. So the first city we did this Creative City Index thing, Bilbao gave us money to do it. We did the evaluation, but they would never really say self-reflective things that were rather negative about themselves, even though Look, objectively speaking, they've done amazing things. We know that. So they could also say, look, we've done that badly. So that's one answer to your question. I think those places with an identity thing have that funny paradox of often being a bit too like this, confident, but then also showing through the chippiness a bit of lack of confidence. Mm-hmm. Then there are places, I'll give you another one which you'll know about, is Mannheim is next to Heidelberg and Ludwigshafen, which is just a German thing. Heidelberg, the romantic city of Central Europe. Oh, so wonderful and all of that. Is it really so wonderful? Question mark. Mannheim, unfortunately destroyed in the war. Isn't that ugly? Where in fact, Mannheim has really done incredibly interesting things around, I mean, the creative economy, you could say, but I mean, that's such a bigger story. But they set up the first center for music education, where the Pop Academy, where Sony's managing director was a co-director and a drummer. So, of course, the students tended to get a job at the end of the day because they had both of these forms of knowledge. So Mannheim is chippy, but actually has something to offer. So there's a lot of that going on all the time, all the time.
I think you totally see that in the Montreal-Toronto divide of all the business went to Toronto after the referendum, which was like so, that was so narrow in terms of how close Quebec came to leaving Canada. Mm-hmm. But then the creative industries in Montreal have really thrived because it's become a cheaper place to live. It's got a chip on its shoulder. There's an ability to go and play around and be wrong. Whereas in Toronto, it's very much a, you can't really be wrong because that would show a sign of weakness. And I think it's a really interesting way. The two cities are like, it's kind of like, I've heard someone else put it this way of like, Ottawa's like the diligent sibling. Toronto's the older, more successful sibling, and Montreal's the weird sister who only occasionally comes home for Christmas. I love that analogy of it because it kind of does speak to how the three cities operate.
No, that's very good. And also, I mean, Peter Hall, who I really admired, you know, who wrote that magisterial book about cities through history. We worked quite a lot together when he was still alive, but he reminded me that many of the innovations, for example, in the cultural sphere, happened from secondary cities. So the first visual art gallery, as we understood it today, was in Poland in Lodz, or Wódź, as it's pronounced there. Just as an example, you know, things happened in Memphis before they happened somewhere else and so on, or in Glasgow before London and so on. So it is true that when you're out of the spotlight, you can often do things. I mean, just because I'm doing stuff in Portugal at the moment, Lisbon's very centralized, the Portuguese government, blah, 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 controls a lot of things. But there's a city called Braga. Okay, have you ever heard of Braga?
I was on the jury
of the European Capital of Innovation, and they became the capital of innovation for smaller cities. And when I look at it, Christ, you've done some amazing things. This was a sleepy place with a horrible former mayor, but suddenly you had a new mayor who for 12 years was listening to young people. I interviewed some of these younger people who've now become quite important in the city, and he said, I was just so amazed. This mayor comes to me and actually listens to me and then did something I suggested. So there are surprises in terms of, it's not all the flashy cities that we know of where interesting things are happening.
The other one of those is like the west coast of Ireland, so like Limerick and Galway, like partly because Dublin has become so expensive and the infrastructure hasn't really grown to meet the growth of the city. But a lot of people have just gone, well, my family's from Galway, so why would I leave Galway? I'm going to start my tech business here. They have some of the Ryanair so they can get around to investors. But I think that's a really like interesting example of those places that are a bit less sexy. Now they're having their own problems because housing prices there have gone up so much. So what made you successful ends up becoming a little bit of the hindrance in the later on. It's a new challenge. But I think there's so many places like that that we don't really talk about.
That's absolutely right. But what you're also highlighting there is actually the basic dynamic of what happens in cities, isn't it? Attraction then leads to higher prices. Making something gentrifying is always seen as a bad word. But if gentrifying means just improving a public space and the area and walkability and stuff like that, we want gentrification in that sense. in a sense, I want the conditions to be better. Now, that leads to all these things we know. That means, from my point of view, we've got to be imaginative in terms of incentives and regulations to bend the market to, I would say, bigger picture purposes, social balance and stuff like that. I mean, to give you an example, I live near a place called Stroud, which is probably the most, or one of the most alternative places in Britain. The Sunday Times, I don't know why, I said, best place to live in Britain, Stroud. Christ, next moment, prices go up. Do I know that? My daughter's just bought a house, you know, immediately. That, I mean, these are obviously dilemmas that you've discussed in many of your podcasts.
I think there's something really interesting in that you use the gentrification word, and I think sometimes people try and avoid it. But often the reaction to gentrification is actually we want to stay what we are. And I think a lot of the people in the neighborhood don't want to stay what they don't want to stay what they are. They want to stay where they are. And it's the how does the neighborhood evolve, or the town evolve, or the city evolve to suit them? And I think we sometimes get lost between this sort of it's gentrification or it's the status quo. And there's not actually, gentrification can take multiple different forms where it should benefit the people who are originally there. I think that's a lost nuance in urbanism.
You just summarized something which I really like when you said they don't necessarily want to stay what they are. They don't want crappy, horrible, whatever, but they might want to stay where they are. And to make that where they are better might mean something that someone later says was gentrification, whereas in fact it was just improving their livability condition.
I think of this with friends that live in a neighborhood of Brooklyn that it's definitely gentrifying. But you can see it's like pushing out a lot of the people that made the reason people want to move there is partly cheap housing, but partly because it's cool. But if you get to the point where like all the cool people move, and it's happened to lots of neighborhoods in Brooklyn, where like I lived in Williamsburg, but I moved there as it went from cool to nice. And by the time I left, it was a bit dull. And it's still nice, but it's not got that sort of thing, that magnet that really attracts you into it. That's now somewhere else in Brooklyn. And I think that that's a sort of challenge that a lot of cities kind of have, is we often have a vision of what we might want to become, but we never really take a linear path to that vision. And we probably end up in places with lots of unintended consequences, positive and negative. But then it's, what do you do next and how do you evolve for that? And I think that's something we really struggle with sort of exploring about where are we going and how we get there and then what will it mean next? I don't know if that comes up in a lot in your work.
You're talking about one of the basic problems of all of this city making in general, which is there's a lot to say, for example, is it only a certain group that's attracted to the original Williamsburg you were just talking about? That's an issue, perhaps, or not. But the point is, how do you maintain something, an atmosphere through time, which still has sort of the liveliness or perhaps edginess or whatever it is you want? And that it's that thing through time. We know the classic thing that you probably, and I think it was a Canadian graffiti that says artists are the vanguard of gentrification or something like that, which is partly true. So they make an area a bit safe. Then the people say, oh, it's a bit safe, a bit edgy. And then the lawyers come in and then the so-and-so, and then the social profile has completely changed. And then you then still have graffiti, but it's sort of in this one little box, which is commissioned by the graffiti authority or something. So these are our dilemmas. I mean, I think what for me quite interesting, what I'm always trying to do, and I'm not saying this provides the answer, I'm always trying to go back to what are the principles behind what we're trying to achieve? And I'm coming back to such simple words that might sound trivial, but one of the things I like about cities is that they're more open than closed. I'm not saying either or, you know, they're more imaginative than too traditional, but they do blend the past and the future. So all of these things that are seeming contradictory in development, you need to find ways of bridging these gaps all the time. And that I think reminds me that, okay, what you're saying is this is all changing, it's not in our control. There needs to be some basic sort of dialogue. When I say dialogue, I don't mean continually talking, but some sort of, I don't know what to call it because the words I'm using are not really very good, but a public discussion culture where that's sort of more open. So for example, you know, one of the things we discussed and you had ideas about is what are the bad ideas in cities? Because there are a lot of them. Now, It's very easy for me now to say Le Corbusier, he was absolute crap. Yeah. But perhaps at that moment in time, perhaps it was too smoky and polluting and stuff like that. And perhaps one did want to separate things out. I mean, personally, I disagree with that in any case. But nevertheless, I'm just trying to not pretend that I would have been so good and so clever and so forward-looking that knew that this would all lead to disaster. So I think there's a combination of humility, and I know I'm drifting off your question, but that's life. I think a bit of humility is quite good, because quite clearly some of the ideas we've had have been bad, but perhaps we would have done them ourselves.
You triggered a thought, which is, wasn't in my set of questions, but when have I ever followed these on these podcasts? But you talk about Corbusier, and it got me thinking, I know it's not a Corbusier thing, but it got me thinking about the Barbican and Park Hill Flats in Sheffield. And I think, like, lots of people love the Barbican. I think it's one of the most hideous buildings, sort of sets of buildings out there, but each their own. And Park Hill Flats in Sheffield was at one point one of the most dangerous housing estates in Britain. Now it's one of the most desirable places to live in a secondary city. And it's likewise, the Barbican is an incredibly desirable place for a lot of people to live. And I think there's something really interesting in what you were saying around, you do lots of consultation before you do a project. You do practically no consultation after a project's happened.
Yeah.
So like, what are all the things that we intended to be good? But you know what? These streets in the sky aren't really working for us. Yeah. But we've proven that we can take buildings that didn't work and turn them into buildings that do. So I think there's something really interesting there around, like, how do you take the flawed philosophies or the flawed executions of philosophies that might not necessarily have been wrong and turn them into something desirable? And I don't think anybody's doing that. But I don't know. I'd love to get your take on that.
Well, I mean, one of the things about a flawed philosophy is sort of random high rise, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, a lot of British cities, just as an example, since you originally come from Britain, you know that lots of places, student housing, we've got no money, let's just build sort of random, ugly student housing in there. But it all depends how you do it. And I was really very impressed when, you know, in Vancouver, which lots of people obviously admire and respect, where you've got, let's say, the high rise, but you've got a sort of, what do you call it? A four or five story thing in front of it. So as you're facing the high rise, it's not sort of hitting you like something. It's sort of layered. And that layering, I think, is in a sense a solution to something that might have been a bit sort of overwhelming. You know, it's just straight in front of you. The same is in some of the Victorian streets in Melbourne. They've done that. You know, you see something that's cradled in a nice way around, and then the high rise is in the middle behind it. So it feels semi-comfortable and approachable. So I do think there are solutions. And sometimes in this case, there might have not been, people might have thought of that in advance. So the key question is, how can you retrofit some things that are really bad? Because I'm just thinking about the Barbican and those, you know, walkways now, because it's an expensive part of London and all that, very central. So I understand where people like it. But if this was just in Basingstoke or
no one would live there.
Would one have enough resources to humanize that? And I think, you know, I said earlier the word principles, and when you use words like principles and you say a principle, it all sounds a bit wishy-washy. But, you know, and I'm about to say something that sounds wishy-washy, which is, if we think of it in a human-centered way, which is back to psychology, how do I feel, and use that as a primary thing, I think you can avert many of the problems or make it a bit better. I mean, if we take Dubai, I know Dubai pretty well because I was there for many times working on the future. One could already see then what they were doing. They were basically getting Texan consultants in who were used to 8-lane motorways, ramming them straight down with no sense of a network, how networks work and people can escape. So if there was an incident somewhere in Sheikh Zayed Road, you know, there'd be a tailback forever. And now they're trying to retrofit and then have sort of more intimate places and spaces, and it just all feels not quite. They did a wrong decision, in my view, initially, using the wrong template of what makes a city work. And another point, we shouldn't, you know, build I mean, Dubai has, you know, incredibly ambitious, and you have to admire some of the things that they do. But they did have this simplistic notion, the medical city, the shopping area, the education city. Well, that's not quite how cities work. You know, it's more blended, which is why so many people are going back, because European cities have got something, is to this sort of more intimate thing.
But there's also only so much that our brains can really take in, right? So there's all the, I can't remember the exact numbers, but we're not really designed to live in cities. We're designed to live in groups of a couple of hundred people, because we can only really remember so many faces, so many names. We can only really like keep on top of what's going on in so many lives, so that you can kind of get this point where like you're overwhelmed. I think someone's made this interesting analogy with the internet, with AI at the moment, of like AI models. They're sort of designed like people have tried to design them like human brains, but they're being shoved full of so much information, they're overwhelmed. And I think there's something like interesting about that around, especially cities like Dubai, because they've kind of been developed from scratch and so much has been thrown into them, but they're almost overwhelmed by the amount of stuff. So the way that we naturally try and zone it is sort of, I'm going to compartmentalize that over there, but you're right, it doesn't quite work. And you sort of have to go back to like a smaller scale of urbanism and then apply that out. And how does that work in a big city? I think that's fascinating without knowing the answer.
No, but that is really quite an important thing, because then we're back to these words. I mean, when I'm going back to feelings, you know, we're talking about, I said, human-centered, then intimacy, you know, this sense you can feel, you can see my hands moving back and forward, the way you're sort of navigating a city rather than some linear thing that goes into nothingness. But there, that's the pressure. You know, I mean, you were referring a minute ago just to Robin Dunbar's number of 150, and you're completely right. That is significant. And we at the moment, there is a narrative, you know, cities are great, they're agglomerations, they're centres of opportunity and all of that. Well, actually, we should also talk about, you know, the opposite side. It's too much. It's just a concrete stuff. It's lifeless, endless asphalt, etc., etc. And, you know, I mean, one of the issues is rarely talked about is, you know, when I was born, there were 2.1 billion or something people in the world. Now there are 8 billion. Now, you just know that is even too much. You know, we know, therefore, pandemics will happen as you, I don't know, lift up the old soil where things are locked in and stuff like that. So there are a lot of issues we don't really talk about in this sort of endless growth. There's more. And what you get, of course, plus an aging population, you get these complicated problems as who's going to support all these older folks and stuff like that. So there's a lot of other stuff going on as well.
There's an interesting thing around cities that get really, really big. They end up having multiple centres. So to come back to that Dubai thing of have like the medical city, the shopping city, etc. It's not necessarily wrong. It's not right, but I don't think it's completely wrong. But like one of the things that makes London a great place is that actually you don't all congregate into Oxford Street. You actually go to different, it's got multiple sort of centres of a city. And I think Paris is trying to do better at connecting its sort of suburbs together, so that not everything congregates into the middle. There's something really interesting to how does that change with how you experience your city, so that you can then get around to, you're not stuck in your little piece of it. You can get around, and like it's healthy for people to go to places that look and feel different. If someone's feeling lonely, I think there's actually doctors in the Netherlands that will prescribe train tickets and just be like, just go somewhere else for the day and you'll feel, your brain will feel different. There's something to that, but like it's very fluffy, and I think we find it really hard to talk about it. And because it's fluffy, we get a bit self-conscious about talking about it, and then people kind of assume it's not correct.
I mean, I think, as you know, of course, the larger cities tend to have their transport networks all sort of flowing into the centre, and then getting from a slightly peripheral place to another is incredibly difficult, because you often have to go into the centre and go out again and stuff like that. I think it's true, the moment you get a bigger city, then obviously there are centres with their own distinctiveness, and that's good. One of the things about the city, and I'm just speaking in a sort of classic sense, that one way of defining the city centre historically, you know, where those institutions were, it was sort of the neutral space, if I can call it that, where the city as a whole could meet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now that's
like the forum.
In a sense, it's a forum at a bigger scale. You know, the central library's there, the council, the whatever, the central whatever. Now, what that reminds me of as we're just talking is that fora idea and stuff like that, is you do need, whatever it is, I think you need convening places in cities where difference meets. I mean, for me, we've done a lot of work about the intercultural city and how people from different backgrounds meet or don't meet and stuff like that. And increasingly, you know, if I even look at my own friendship group, it's not as diverse as it could be, even though I might say, oh, yes, I like diversity and all of that. But I would like to find opportunities to meet a greater diversity of people, because how I do that, by the way, is just being so bloody nosy and asking people something. So like 2 days ago, I sniffed around, not sniffed, but, you know, I just saw a guy in the house and I said, oh, what are you doing? Can I come? And we started a conversation. And he started telling me, he was a sort of plumbing type guy, about astronomy and all his telescopes. And I'm thinking, yes, yes, you know, because that's, again, I mean, if you, in a way, for people to be city dwellers, they should really like people, ideally, they should like people. And the architecture should reflect that it likes people. And I think a lot of architecture, and I'm, don't now ask me the ones that I think don't like people, but I said, well, you can if you like. There are lots of architects. I think, do you like people? Yeah. I mean, does Rem Koolhaas really like people? I'm just asking, does he like people? Is it, do you see what I'm saying?
So I'm thinking of Baku, and I really like Baku because they actually have some of the most interesting architecture. Anyone who does a carpet museum in the shape of a carpet, well done. But it's not, if you go into old Baku, it's all the old city is all designed around interactions. So that might be a cup of tea, smoke shisha, people at opposite tables who don't necessarily know each other talking to one another. You go to those big sort of statement-y architecture projects, there's nowhere to sit. They almost feel like they're designed to be beautiful rather than to like push people together. And yep. I think there's something really interesting there around, like Dubai has this, I think, where like, it's good for clubs where you kind of need to be a member. It's very bad for how do we bring different groups of people in the city and get them to come together. And maybe that's by choice and by design, or maybe it's by architectural ego. I don't know. But I think that's really important that we don't talk about. We don't talk about that, and we should do.
Well, it's quite interesting. I went to an event yesterday where a group of people called Absurd Intelligence, AI, who connect a lot with people like Brian Eno, they put on this event, which is called The Fate of Britain. F-E-T-E / F-A-T-E. And what they're really trying to say is, you know, we're in Britain, they're more left than right, let's put it like that, but yeah, we don't have those distinctions. But the way we all started for 35 minutes was leaving aside that classic where you get a group of three people and you just say who you are, I'm Ian and I do this, blah, 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 and I say that, and then it was quite interesting whoever I spoke to. Then it said, they said, we all stood up and they said, anyone who's more into democracy, go towards the right of the room. Anyone more in culture, go to the left. And then all these people moving around, you say, well, who are you? And the next question, do you feel you've got enough media exposure or not? Left, right, etc. Are you on about the end of the world? Net zero people. Or are you about tomorrow? People who run events. All I'm saying is everything, the theme, and then the visualization person, everything we said, connection. And that's what we're really saying. Cities are places where strangers could meet or should meet, I think. I think the dialogue of difference, just as a slogan, is really key. Because I'm noticing myself, you know, I'm often, you know, have false perceptions of people. And I'm not saying I'm prejudiced, but do you know what I mean?
We all are a bit.
What?
We all are a bit.
Yeah, exactly. So where next with the future of cities? That's a good question, isn't it?
So you're taking me in the direction I wanted to go, which is I'm reading a book about 90s Britpop at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And admittedly, that might not make you think about the future. But all the stories that come out of it, it's often place that has driven these bands together, whether they went to school together, whether they drank in the same pub, whether they ended up at the same gigs or whatever it might have been. And there's also a lovely analog piece of, we need a bass player, stick an ad in Melody Maker and hope and see who pops up and see who we get on with. The theory behind the internet was really meant, and social media was meant to be bringing us all together. If anything, we're seeing how much it's, especially the news events of this week, it's like driving us apart. Does that make you think there's a future of cities that, do we end up pushing ourselves back to these places that really matter and we meet people that we wouldn't have ordinarily met? Do you think that is maybe where the future of cities goes, as we're probably becoming a bit more attuned to the devices that we all have in our pocket and we're always connected to, perhaps aren't giving us the connection to other people that we thought they originally promised?
That's definitely true. I mean, when I thought a bit about that, in when I was doing all this stuff about the nomadic world and people moving here, there, everywhere, I kept on thinking about, you know, the way hyper-parochialism is too much and can be make you feel imprisoned and stuff like that, and you want to see the wider world. All of these things I was looking at, do you want to be more tribal, clannish, or do you more, let's say, cosmopolitan, stuff like that? But then again, back to my point about, let me try and think behind that. I think the desire for connection is there and is as powerful as ever. Obviously, the means are different, but I think there's beginning to be, and I'm just using this event I went to yesterday just as a simplistic example, the pleasure that people had in doing something together. And then in the end, there was some sort of bizarre sing-song we all did, which could feel completely embarrassing. And that's not necessarily we all love each other or anything like that, we go off. But that was a different sort of connection than, let's say, a Zoom connection or whatever connection we're doing here virtually there. And I think this is pretty satisfactory, our conversation. I'm enjoying it. But I know that when we physically were together, there was a different dimension. And I think people are remembering that again. I'm not saying it's an aha moment, but I think connection is really key. But physical is really great.
Do you think we're building the spaces for this in cities? Because I see a lot of talk about people going back to the office, but the office is still a desk and a place you plug your laptop in. And most of them aren't necessarily great at, this is a chip I have on my shoulder, of if you work for HSBC in a building that also has, I don't know, Procter & Gamble beneath it, you actually don't come together with the people from Procter & Gamble other than maybe you're in the elevator together, or maybe you're standing behind each other in the line for the coffee shop downstairs. And I wonder, are places, or are you starting to see places go, hang on a minute, how do we start to design some of this back into the system? Because it's slipped away. And I think that's what keeps me up at night, weirdly.
You know, it's a good thing to be kept up at night. I think this is one of the very big issues, but I think this needs to partly be orchestrated. In a sense, it needs to be curated softly because you don't want to over-exaggerate. But you know, of course, about, let's say, the Finns, and then you meet in the sauna and all of that, which is a good experience. I think, yes, one has to be slightly self-conscious about it. I mean, you know, whoever the owners of areas and buildings are, which then gets you into sort of what are the new functions cities need? You know, do three of these tower blocks need to have some person who is a connecting device? So I think gathering, I mean, these are the words I've said, connecting already, connecting, gathering, convening, curating are all quite, mostly start with the letter C, are quite useful and very important functions, which is important as the physical planner who's looking at this is as important as the engineer. And I'm not downgrading, by the way, any of these people. I'm just saying, let us all be, with mutual respect, part of this thing that I call, or we call, city making. And I might call it the art of city making, if you see what I mean. I mean, the book I wrote a long time ago, or when was it, 20 years ago, called The Art of City Making, I think it starts off with, city making is an art, not a formula, but some strong principles may help it along its way. But you get the idea. And yeah. One of those principles was, you know, human-centered and all of that.
I think you definitely get this sort of the softer, more sort of psychology-driven folks. It can sometimes come across in a way of we're arguing against the engineers and the economists. And I think that I notice myself doing it in a lot of things. I think a lot of the things I start writing from is like, this is wrong. This is what we might want to do instead, which isn't necessarily the most helpful way of going about it, because you end up pushing those other people away. But at the end of the day, someone has to build it, and they know how to build it, and we maybe don't.
Yes. Well, it's also because we also have cliches about probably about an engineer, what an engineer is. If you're not an engineer, you know, you might have a cliche about them. But, you know, once there's bloody fixing something that you've got in your house with an engineering mindset, you say, my God, are you wonderful? Also, engineers are not necessarily narrow-minded by definition. They're not by definition narrow-minded. So that comes back to conversation, another word that starts with the letter C.
What are you most excited about right now? What is it, places, are there developments, are there initiatives that like you maybe look at? And maybe that's because maybe these like belong to some of the letter C's that you've talked about, but hosting the Creative Bureaucracy Festival, are you noticing some of those like really leading lights of that's a wonderful example of creative bureaucracy at work, or these are great places that are bringing together connections that had previously been lost? What do you look at and really gets you going, yes, that's the things that we should be talking about?
Well, I think I've already implied what really gets me excited. It's actually when different, we're talking cities and the city, lots of different people, lots of different views, lots of different so-and-sos. When you find contexts where somehow they're aligning a bit, that's really what makes me feel good. When you suddenly find that you're a bit on the same wavelength, but you need to, from my point of view, provide opportunities for that to occur. So that's why one of the projects I'm very involved in is about intergenerational stuff, just because the woman, Robin Bennett, who helped me do a lot on the Creative Bureaucracy Festival, was 45 years younger than me. I love the fact that we never talked about our age difference. So this is another example of connecting. So I'm back to all of that sort of thing. So that excites me when I actually experience that. And when I experience personally, but that's why you need convenings, events and stuff, when I suddenly hear about people who come from a completely different space. Now, some people might say, don't be so bloody stupid and don't be so bloody curious all the time. Why don't you just sit down and relax and shut up? They could say that. But, you know, my mother said, and I think my father said it as well, said, look, you can obviously do lots of exercise as you get older, but one big thing is just stay curious. That'll keep you alert.
Where do you go when you're in that mind? Like, let's say you're not an event, you're not working. Where do you go? And what do you do to sort of turbocharge that curiosity in your mind? What do you look for? Because you said something really interesting when we were in Copenhagen, where you started talking about like how a city smells. And I thought that was a really interesting point of there are certain evocative scents of a city, but like, I'd be curious, like, let's go with the, how do you ignite that curiosity or fuel that curiosity?
Well, I think it's two things at the same time, actually, because bizarrely enough, I live sort of in the middle of nowhere, but that's partly because I'm always in cities. And so the ignition could also be nurture and nourishment. You need a bit of nourishment, which is, do you remember you were talking about overwhelming, feeling overwhelmed? So I feel I need a certain sort of emptiness. So the emptiness, which could also be sometimes a distraction. So the dog I have might in a minute just come up and say, look, stop talking and do something with me. So there's that. That's a precondition in a sense. And then with that, then it's a bit like I need food. Then I try to go into context, particularly I have a ritual going to the market here and then having chats with people in a what we call a mini salon. And then with a couple of friends, we might say, there was one we did, which you would love. What is authenticity? My God, discuss for half an hour. And then you just continue doing something else and get on with your day. But to me, it's all this sort of context of providing, in the end, you need a place or a space for that to happen is really what I'm saying. Do you see partly what I'm also saying is you need a sort of retrenchment back and then a sort of movement forward. Now, that might be the home and then going out, but it might also be the public space, which I can look out from and then perhaps engage. But I'm sort of safe in that public space, which if it's raining is covered, etc.
I think there's this lovely analogy that John Cleese makes around creativity, where he talks about the open mode and the closed mode. And he can talk about it in that there's the work that you do when the door's open, and there's the work that you do when the door is closed. And one is better for sort of opening, broadening your mind, and one is better for just focusing and getting a task done. But I think that exists in the context of how we experience cities, that the closed space can't just be the place where you retreat to. The closed space can also be a cozy nook of a pub where you can like read a book or write an email or whatever it might be. But then you can also have the ability in that same space to go be nosy, like you said earlier, of like, hello, what do you like? Who are you? What do you do? And have a chat with a stranger. And I think I like that sort of almost like the best cities are the places where you can dip in and out of that.
No, it's very good. I mean, the way I think I'm saying the same thing as you, because I agree with what you're saying, is this: it's so delicious. I'm using the word delicious on purpose to be alone together. If you see what I'm saying. Yeah. So you're alone, let's say, in this proverbial cafe, sitting at a table, nobody's particularly bothering you, you may be with your laptop or not, and you're doing whatever I'm doing now, just folding my arms and just sort of looking into the far horizon, and then, oh my God, here's someone.
If there's a common theme amongst basically everybody I've interviewed for this, is everyone's a little bit voyeuristic. Like we get a pleasure from just seeing how other people are going about their day and what they're doing and why are they making that choice? Why are they doing that? Why are they ordering that?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that brings us together.
Yeah, I think voyeurism, that's a good way of putting it, voyeurism brings us together.
Be careful with how we use it.
I know, but we're using it in the good sense, i.e. just looking at the world go by, yeah.
So I like to end these episodes on, if you give people a magic wand, so forget about the constraints or some of the realities. If you had a magic wand for cities, what would you do with it?
Well, if I had a magic wand for cities, it would be providing many contexts where people would get to know each other and break down the boundaries between them and what that would mean, creating, you might call them soft infrastructures, which is not only green grass, but something which feels like public living rooms and things of that nature. So the organization I started many, 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 many years ago was called Comedia, Communications Media. How do you get your message across? So you can see that very much what I'm on about is this either communicating to the outside world, but even individually communicating. So that is really the core and the essence of what I feel who I am. So what I'm reflecting towards this magic wand is, of course, things that just sort of feel part of me, rather than saying, I don't know, something complex, which I don't even want to think about.
And in terms of, like, when you think about that, like how you bring that together, is there like a sort of place that really excites you right now where we talked about Braga, you've talked about some part like Dusseldorf, but like, are there places where you look at and go, you know what, they're doing that really well and that's what we can learn from?
Well, I mean, whenever you look at places, there's always something, yeah. But then there's this endless forgetting as well. So I'm sorry to complicate your question. But let's take just two random places. Turin does some things really interestingly, and I like Turin. You know, it's not as Milan, but it's got something sort of solid there, but also quite open and quite interesting things. Then another one, which is the poster child of urban innovation, who we gave a prize to recently in one of the projects I'm involved in, which is Curitiba, which I went to, which is well known, as you know, for the urban acupuncture idea, Jaime Lerner, and sponge city ideas, which are now new, was already 50 years ago. I saw the garbage collectors collecting garbage, which they dumped somewhere and got money for. And I thought, well, thank God I did actually ultimately get to Curitiba and meet all the Lerner relatives and then be shown around and went into the BRT, the bus rail transit things, et cetera, et cetera. So those were two things which were unfortunately can be described as a bucket list thing, which I don't want to put it like that. But I was pleased to be in Curitiba, but I'm also quite pleased. I lived in Munich, so I'm quite pleased to go back, but then I think, is it overcooked? So there's pleasure with a bit of sadness sometimes. Do you know what I mean? I'm not giving you a straightforward answer, my friend.
No, but you're making me, in the hope of the people who listen to this, think, and I think you're picking on some, what you've done really well through the course of this is you've deliberately not named specifics at points. And then there's other places where you've named places that people wouldn't necessarily jump to. And you call, even as you call Curitiba a poster child of this, I think it's still, a lot of people haven't seen those posters.
All right. Yes.
So
yes,
I like this. The whole point is, like, we need to think for ourselves. You can't just give us all the answers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah.
Charles, this has been a pleasure. I could talk to you all day, but, like, it's a Friday afternoon for you. And, like, what they say, always leave people wanting more.
Okay. Well, that's very nice of you to say that.
So I appreciate, like, really appreciate you doing this. And should we give a little plug for your Stroud thing as well? Because you're doing something very interesting soon.
Right. Well, what I'm doing something I've thought about for a bit, which is a two-day residency in Stroud in the Centre for Future Thinking called Hawkwood. And what I'm basically trying to explore with a few people, it might be 15, 20 or so, the art of city making. What is it really? What can we do together? I can say what I've experienced just simply because I'm older. That doesn't mean I'm right. But then have these other voices, which presumably will be younger voices, and then just really together to try and shape where next with cities? What are the priorities? How can we be clear about what's necessary? Because as you said before, there's so much information overload, and it's nice when things are just simplified but not simplistic. So at least you can say, I need to focus on these three, four things.
I really like that. Simplified but not simplistic is a good mantra. Charles, thank you so much. This is awesome.
Great. Well, it was a pleasure for me too.
Thank you, as always, listening all the way to the end of one of these Challenger Cities podcast episodes. I do need a favour, though. This thing's growing, it's getting traction, it's amazing hearing feedback of people listening to it, but I always need a little bit of a stroke to the ego, and this thing can go bigger and further and wider with your help. So please do give it a like, give it a share, leave us a comment, suggest it to a friend. Yeah, thank you so much, and as always, get in touch if there's people you think we should talk to. See you soon for another episode in what is now series 4 of the Challenger Cities podcast.